Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
When Thomas Aquinas first considers virtue in his magnum opus, the Summa Theologiae, he treats virtue as a kind of habitus or habit. A habitus or a habit is a stable disposition that gives some specificity to our human capacities. Human beings, like other living creatures, are endowed by God with a nature that's oriented towards certain kinds of activity, and we engage in those properly human activities by means of particular powers or capacities that we naturally possess. For example, we are the kinds of creatures that are naturally oriented toward pursuing knowledge of the truth, and we undertake this activity by means of our intellect, a certain capacity that we possess for seeking and knowing the truth. Similarly, we are by nature inclined toward the pursuit of certain kinds of physical pleasures, like those of food and drink, and we are drawn to those things by means of what Aquinas calls our appetites. Although our human capacities are by nature oriented toward specific kinds of activities and toward the attainment of certain kinds of goods, Aquinas also acknowledges that these capacities are also underdetermined by human nature. As free and rational creatures, we're capable of engaging our human capacities in any number of different ways. We do not engage the world, as one scholar puts it, in causally fixed ways, as if we were animals responding to our environments purely by instinct, or computers that move from inputs to outputs algorithmically. Rather, our human capacities, while not wholly indeterminate, are nevertheless not sufficiently focused, not sufficiently honed in, to guarantee that we will pursue a pattern of activity that's both intelligible and relatively consistent. With our human capacities left untutored, unspecified, undeveloped, nothing prevents a person from moving sporadically from one activity to another and from one goal to another without any semblance of overall coherence to his or her life. Habits, according to Aquinas, provide the kind of specification necessary for human beings to act coherently. Habits are a kind of second nature, as he puts it, because they build on and further specify the natural inclinations inherent in us as human beings. For Thomas, the most essential characteristic of a habit is its stability. Habits grant a consistent and enduring direction to our human capacities, so that our orientation towards certain goods and certain activities is deep and abiding. The mark of habit, Aquinas says, is that it's difficult to change. This signals yet another way that habits are second nature. Their stable specification of our human capacities leaves a certain kind of consistency, right? It lends a certain consistency to those capacities' actions. They grant a further inclination beyond the inclination of untutored human nature to our capacities to make them quasi-naturally oriented towards certain ways of acting. Aquinas also says that habits give a degree of promptness to human activity by specifying and orienting our capacities towards certain more concrete, more determinate kinds of action. It's not necessary for us to engage in a lengthy and difficult process of deliberating in every situation. Aquinas' understanding of habit differs in this way from our common way of thinking now about habit as something mindless, right? You think about anything that you'd call a habit, right? Clicking your pen, scratching your beard, right? We typically think about habit as something mindless, automatic, unthinking. Aquinas differs from this, and I'll explain how in a minute, but he does think that habits allow us to act with greater promptness. We can act more quickly, right? Because we don't have to deliberate. Right? We've been sort of determined, we've fixed ourselves to act in a certain way. And finally, Aquinas holds that habits give a certain ease or facility to human action. A capacity that's been specified and trained by a habit doesn't need to overcome obstacles or negotiate an internal struggle about how to act. The process of action is streamlined and therefore given a certain pleasure. To act out of habit is easy. Now, virtue, Aquinas says, is a type of habit. And so as a result, virtue possesses all of these characteristics. Virtues stably specify our capacities and incline them to act in a more determinate, more focused way, and to do so with consistency, promptness, and ease. What sets virtue apart from other kinds of habits, including habits of vice, is that virtues are good habits. This means that the virtues are habits that dispose a person's capacities not merely to act in a specific way, but to act well. Virtue, therefore, involves activity that's aligned with a certain standard by which we can call our activity good. And for human virtue, Thomas argues, that standard is reason. For human beings who are rational animals, to act in accordance with reason is good for us. It's perfective of our nature. And acting contrary to reason is antithetical to who we are as human beings. It's contrary to nature. Thus, Aquinas declares that, quote, human virtue, which makes a man good and his work good, is in accord with man's nature, inasmuch as it accords with reason. And vice is contrary to man's nature, insofar as it's contrary to reason, end quote. While there are any number of habits that perfect us by enabling us to act according to reason, Aquinas argues that the name virtue belongs most properly to a group that he calls moral virtues. These are the habits that perfect our appetites to act according to reason and to desire according to reason. It's the moral virtues, things like justice, temperance, courage, generosity, honesty, that most completely satisfy Thomas's Aristotelian definition of virtue as that which makes a person good and his actions good too. Aquinas argues that intellectual virtues, virtues like knowledge or art or wisdom, perfect our minds. They perfect our intellectual capacity for grasping abstract truths or creating useful artistic or athletic products, don't completely satisfy this definition of virtue. While possessing these kinds of virtues might make one a good economist or a good pianist, they do not necessarily make that person a good human. You can imagine someone using their intellectual virtue of economic knowledge to game the stock market for their own advantage, or someone using their intellectual virtue of piano playing skill to seduce someone else's spouse. The moral virtues, on the other hand, do not merely make someone a good economist or a good pianist, but a good person. This is one of the ways that a virtue like justice or courage or honesty differs from, right, some kind of other skill. It makes the person good as a person and not just in some sphere of life or some realm of activity. The virtues make us good people, Aquinas argues, because they conform our desires and our emotions to reason, so that we can desire and act in the ways that reason demands, which is to say, in ways that are good for us as humans. The virtues enable our desires to become, as Aquinas puts it, rational in a certain way. The virtuous person not only knows what she ought to do, and not only does what she ought to do, but she desires to do what she ought to do. She experiences no internal struggle between reason's judgment and her desires about how to act in each situation. Her capacities for desiring have been so thoroughly permeated by reason that they've become habituated to desire in a rational way. The example I always use with my students is like back in the days when people used cash for things and right, you'd get change back from a cashier. The cashier gives you too much change. You might, if you're not a virtuous person, you might have to like momentarily think to yourself, I know I should give that extra $5 bill back, but I really want it. And you have to sort of hem and haw and overcome a kind of struggle. And maybe you keep the money, maybe you give it back. But in either case, Aquinas would say, you're not virtuous. Even if you do the right thing, virtue has to do with the training of our desires. The virtuous person doesn't need to think twice, doesn't need to engage in this kind of internal civil war between what she knows she should do and what she wants to do. For the virtuous person, there's an alignment between what I know I ought to do, what I want to do, and what in fact I do. Virtue gives a kind of harmony to the human person. So this alignment of our reason and our desire is precisely what allows for the promptness and pleasure that acting according to virtue gives. For example, the virtue of courage enables someone consistently to experience the emotion of fear in a reasonable way, so that the courageous person is neither paralyzed by fear nor overcome by recklessness. Similarly, the virtue of temperance allows a person to desire physical pleasures, like the pleasures of eating and drinking and sexual intimacy, in a reasonable way, neither prudishly rejecting the good things of God's creation, nor wantonly overindulging them. In these examples, we see that the moral virtues hit a certain kind of sweet spot, what Aquinas calls the mean. between too much and too little, between excess and deficiency. Now, the mean, as Aquinas understands it, isn't the arithmetical midpoint between excess and deficiency. For Aquinas, the mean of virtue is a reasoned judgment about what kind of response is most fitting in a given set of circumstances. So there's a certain dynamism and flexibility here. The good at which the moral virtues aim, Aquinas writes, can be brought about in various ways and not in the same way in all cases. The moral virtues need the guidance and direction of prudence, of wisdom, to be able to discern the mean of virtue, the fitting response in each situation. So it's the moral virtues, guided by prudence, that perfect our capacities for desire so that we pursue the good things of this world in accordance with reason, and therefore exemplify human virtue in its fullest sense. Now, to think about how you acquire these virtues. Aquinas says that human virtue, like other kinds of habits, like piano playing or speaking a language or knowledge of economics, is cultivated and acquired by a process of habituation through human acts. That is to say, by repeatedly acting in a certain way, we develop a stable disposition to act in the same way, with even greater promptness, ease, and pleasure. Consider the case of sledding. I gave this a different talk and used this example unthinkingly at the University of Arizona a couple months ago, and just got weird stares when I started talking about sledding. But I feel like we're on safer ground here. Okay. So after a fresh snowfall, right, the first pass down a hill on a sled is pretty difficult. It's slow. It's plodding. The snow is not packed down. There are no tracks for the grooves of the sled to fit into. There are probably leaves and branches and other obstacles that hinder your descent down the hill. But once you've taken your sled down the same path on that hill a few times, the snow becomes more compact, the grooves on your sled have formed a path in the snow, and you can sail down the hill smoothly and effortlessly. The same holds true in the moral life. Aquinas, using a different analogy, argues that habituation in virtue occurs through a repeated series of actions, just, quote, as many drops hollow out a rock. But by consistently performing virtuous acts, over time, Aquinas thinks, one comes to cultivate the habit of virtue itself. Now, this is easier said than done. After all, a person who's not yet virtuous possesses, or might possess, chaotic or disordered desires that are not yet aligned with reason, or perhaps even worse, possesses desires that have been habituated viciously. Moreover, the moral novice likely lacks the practical wisdom necessary to discern rightly where the mean of virtue lies. Aquinas recognizes that the challenge of growth in virtue, man has a natural aptitude for virtue, but the perfection of virtue must be acquired by man by means of some kind of training. Now, it's difficult to see how a man could suffice for himself in the matter of this training, since the perfection of virtue consists chiefly in withdrawing man from undue pleasures, to which we are above all inclined, and especially the young, who are more capable of being trained. Consequently, a man needs to receive this training from another in order to arrive at the perfection of virtue. End quote. Aquinas recognizes that the process of growing in virtue is not a solitary, isolated endeavor, but it's a process of teaching and learning. For Thomas, law plays a crucial role in this process. In contrast to contemporary views of law as something that's value neutral and aimed at maximizing the liberty of individuals to do as they please, Aquinas holds that the goal of law is to make human beings virtuous by instructing them in what is good. Additionally, Aquinas says that it's necessary for us to give proper attention to others who are wise. This is not simply because they're well-suited to give good advice about how we should act, but also because their example might prove instructive for us. For Aquinas, it's a repeated refrain in his writings that, quote, examples move more than words. Thus, in order to grow in virtue, it's crucial to pay attention not only to the advice, but also to the example of those who are already virtuous. Now, this insight neither originates nor ends with Aquinas. In his Nicomachean Ethics, the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle speaks about the one he calls the phronimos, the wise person, as the living model of right reason in action. And Aristotle proposes that we should look to the example of the phronimos in order to determine what kinds of actions are appropriate for a good life. In fact, Aristotle even goes so far as to define virtue with reference to the practically wise person. His definition of virtue is that it's a state of character lying in a mean relative to us that's determined by the way the phronimos would determine it. More recently, virtue ethicists, both philosophers and theologians, have developed theories of moral education that are centered around the imitation of moral exemplars. For example, Julia Annis, who's an ancient philosopher, argues, quote, "We learn to be virtuous from a teacher or role model who shows us how to do something which we then try to copy for ourselves." And the Catholic moral theologian Servé Pinquers proposes that growth in virtue occurs, quote, "within the context of a growing harmony between a disciple and a teacher." In these accounts of virtue ethics, moral exemplars, a virtuous person that we can look up to and imitate, serves an important educational, pedagogical role by inspiring people to pursue virtue and by providing a concrete example of virtue for them to imitate. Now, the usefulness of these moral exemplars for promoting our growth in virtue depends on our ability to recognize them as virtuous and for their moral excellence to inspire us to imitate their example. With respect to our ability to identify these exemplars, one virtue ethicist, her name is Linda Zagzebski, argues that there's something inherent in us that detects excellence. And she calls this the emotion of admiration. She says that our encounters with moral exemplars sort of naturally elicit in us a certain kind of admiration that enables us to recognize their ethical excellence and to experience what psychologists call elevation, a feeling of being uplifted by witnessing moral excellence in action. And crucially, Zagzebski says that this experience of admiration is motivating. It doesn't merely provoke a feeling of awe, right? We just feel sort of like, whoa. But it also stimulates a desire to imitate the exemplar in precisely the ways that we find her admirable. Now, exactly what it means to imitate a moral exemplar is actually a very complicated question, right? Just the idea of actually what it means to imitate someone is a very interesting question. Psychologists do all sorts of research on children and the ways that they learn by imitating. And there's all sorts of interesting debates about when you're imitating, what exactly are you doing? How do you interpret the actions of the model that you're trying to copy? How do you determine, like, what are the essential things that I really need to copy? What's the kind of excess stuff that I can ignore? It's a really complicated process. We'll return to that later. For now, let me suggest that the kind of imitation that's most effective for growing in virtue is not merely a mechanical copying of the exemplar's virtuous actions. By itself, this kind of act replication, that's insufficient to cultivate the kind of stable, intelligent, and flexible habit that virtue is. It remains kind of extrinsic and detached, so that the imitator's knowledge of the model is just confined to observing what this person out there does and trying to copy it for herself. Instead, I think that the kind of imitative learning that's most helpful for cultivating the virtues is a decidedly relational, interactive encounter between the learner and the model. Now, this encounter between the person who wants to grow in virtue and the exemplar who's already virtuous, it needs to be rooted in some kind of real encounter. Now, this encounter might be direct in the sense of, like, actually knowing the virtuous person and having a relationship with them, or it might be indirect, right? It might be mediated by reading stories or narratives, right? A diary that the virtuous person has written, or reading accounts of the virtuous person's life written by people who knew that person. But either way, there needs to be a kind of intimate familiarity between the one who wants to grow in virtue and the model they want to imitate. It can't be something that's abstract, external, at a distance. There needs to be a certain kind of intimate familiarity. Because this kind of intimate familiarity allows one to grasp not only the exemplar's virtuous acts, the things they do, but also to gain a kind of intimate knowledge of the exemplar's aims, motivations, desires, way of thinking that animate her virtuous action so that we can strive to be like the exemplar in the sort of maximal way. Part three, that's the sort of really theory-heavy aspect about what virtue is and how it's acquired. Now I want to think about the saints. For Catholics, the saints might seem to be prime candidates to serve as moral exemplars, worthy of our imitation if we wish to grow in virtue. Indeed, Pope John Paul II writes that, quote, by their eloquent and attractive example of a life completely transfigured by the splendor of truth, the church's saints light up every period of history by reawakening its moral sense, end quote. Yet, in light of the account of virtue, moral exemplarity, and imitative learning that we've just considered, I think there are at least three obstacles that might make us hesitant to adopt the saints as our models and to imitate their example. So first, as I noted above, a key feature of most accounts of learning from moral exemplars is that we identify these exemplars by reflecting on the people that we intuitively admire. Moral exemplar is someone that, as I reflect on them, I find really admirable. But here's the first obstacle. The saints don't always provoke our admiration. From a certain standpoint, the saints can appear bewildering rather than admirable, and unsettling rather than inspiring, because of the seemingly extreme nature of their lives. Consider, for example, a scene recounted in Sigrid Undset's biography of St. Catherine of Siena, in which Catherine drank the pus that flowed out of the sores of a sick woman for whom she was caring. The Thomistic Institute wouldn't let me entitle this talk, "Do I Have to Drink the Pus?" But it's episodes like these, I think, that lead some secular philosophers to dismiss the saints as leading lives that, to quote one philosopher, do not constitute a model of personal well-being toward which it would be particularly rational or good or desirable for human beings to strive. The saints, on their view, are moral perfectionists or radical altruists who take moral excellence too far for their own good. From this perspective, the heroic nature of the saints' virtue becomes a source of consternation rather than of admiration. Yet it's not merely the saints' single-minded dedication to moral goodness, if we should even talk about it that way, that makes them a source of bewilderment. It's also the specific form that their moral excellence takes. Another secular ethicist cautions that, quote, we should be wary of trying too hard to live like the saints, many of whom are too zealous or too bizarre for us to imitate, end quote. From the perspective of what this ethicist calls ordinary morality, the saints sometimes appear to defy what we would presume is morally required of us. Another secular philosopher, sums this up well. Quote, the saintly exemplar does not always accord so easily with the moral standards that articulate a culture's highest sense of itself. Often the saints do not just heighten ordinary morality, they implicitly question it by seeming to embody a strange higher standard that doesn't quite fit with the moral system that governs ordinary propriety. The saints don't quite fit the mold of good sense. The saints wouldn't really fit so well in a Jane Austen novel. It seems to me that there are three ways to make sense of this phenomenon. First, we could simply write the saints off as bizarre eccentrics or religious extremists. This is what most secular philosophers tend to do. Second, we could attempt to domesticate the saints by downplaying or ignoring whatever elements of their lives appear eccentric or bizarre to our sensibilities. Intense regimens of asceticism, withdrawal from worldly affairs, immovable witness to their faith until the point of death. Or third, one might hold that the saints can be understood as moral exemplars only from a particular vantage point. On this third view, which is the one that I think is right, the lives of the saints reveal what human moral excellence looks like when it's been elevated and perfected by grace. And this transformation fundamentally alters the character of the virtue that the saints display. The saints only make sense as exemplars of what Aquinas calls infused virtue. According to Aquinas, the infused virtues, which include the virtues like faith, hope, and charity that St. Paul talks about in the first letter to the Corinthians, and also sort of elevated forms of natural virtues like prudence, justice, courage, and temperance, these infused virtues differ from human or natural virtue in a few ways. First, unlike ordinary human virtue, which aims to perfect us at the level of human nature, to make us live flourishing lives in this world, the infused virtues perfect us with a view toward the supernatural goal of union with God in heaven. Second, and as a result of this, the infused virtues operate according to a different standard, according to a different logic than human virtue does. Rather than taking their measure of goodness from reason, the infused virtues act and judge according to what Aquinas calls the divine rule, a certain kind of higher divine wisdom that sheds a greater, more penetrating light on human action. As a result, the acts of the infused virtues may look different than the acts of human virtue. And finally, because the infused virtues direct us toward a goal that exceeds our capacities, human beings are not sort of born equipped with what they need, right, to reach this goal of heaven. That's what grace supplies for us. Aquinas holds that we can't attain the infused virtues just by performing repeated actions over and over again. The infused virtues aren't the product of habituation, the way the virtues I described in the first part are. Rather, the infused virtues are just that. They're infused in us directly by God. They're not products of human effort, but gifts of divine grace. One Thomistic philosopher illustrates the difference between human virtue and infused virtue and its implications for thinking about moral exemplars in a recent book, where she contrasts the courage that led the ancient Spartan king Leonidas and his soldiers to sacrifice their lives to save the Greek peninsula from the invading Persians at the Battle of Thermopylae, against the courage that led St. Stephen, the first martyr of the church, to stand firm in his defense of the faith, even to the point of death. Both are examples of courage. The courage of the king and his soldiers who sacrificed their lives for the good of the city-state, and the courage of the martyr who lays down his life in defense of the faith. This philosopher, Knobel, proposes that we are generally more apt to recognize the admirability of King Leonidas's courage and to want to act like him, even if we'd recognize that we'd likely fail to do so in the moment, than we are to perceive the admirability of Stephen's fortitude. It's easier, at a human level, to admire King Leonidas than it is to admire Stephen. Stephen might just seem like a bizarre eccentric. This difference, she contends, is due to a fundamentally different perspective that the infused virtues give us. She puts it this way. The acquired virtues are ordered to a thoroughly comprehensible good, a good so comprehensible that even the non-virtuous can understand its goodness, the good of saving the city-state. The goodness of the acts of the infused virtues are more difficult for us to grasp. Now, this isn't to say that every action of every saint is just sort of morally opaque to somebody who doesn't possess the infused virtues. You can't admire the saints unless you've got this fundamentally different perspective, right? There's some intersection between the way that the saints live and our sort of perspective on ordinary morality. Nor am I making the claim that every seemingly problematic or even sinful act of the saints is actually an act of virtue in disguise and we just don't see it. Not saying that. Rather, what I want to suggest is that the lives of the saints do not merely confirm our natural knowledge about morality or remind us about moral truths that maybe we've forgotten, although they do both of these things. My point is that the saints also reveal something new. Saints teach us something new and something surprising about the moral life, something that perhaps we could not have known apart from their example, and whose goodness we cannot perceive without a moral vision that's been transformed by grace. And I should add, this transformation of our vision, this transformation of our ability to perceive and admire the excellence of the saints is an ongoing process. Pope Francis himself insists that the saints continue to, quote, confound and surprise the church by their virtue. But even if we're poised to recognize and to admire the saints as exemplars and models of infused virtue, two other problems still loom large. First, if the saints' moral excellence is the result of grace and is manifested in the exercise of virtues that are infused in them by God, then it would seem that imitating the saints doesn't really help our own moral growth. Imitating the saints doesn't enable us to acquire a virtue that we can only receive as a gift. Linda Zygrzebski, one of these philosophers, articulates precisely this problem when she says that the saints don't deserve credit for a gift that falls from heaven, and that such unearned gifts are not excellences that pertain to morality, because they can't be imitated. In the same way, you can't hope to achieve the talent of somebody who's got just a sort of inborn natural talent or a genius, right? No amount of imitating and trying is going to get you there. the objection is, well, if the saints' virtue is given to them by God, like, no amount of copying and trying to be like the saints is going to get you there. While it's true that no amount of human effort can bring us to acquire these infused virtues, this isn't to say that our agency, our action, plays no role in the increase of those virtues once we receive them as gift. The infused virtues are not given to us in their maximal degree. And in fact, we can have these infused virtues given to us by God at our baptism, but not be very good at using them. There is room, indeed necessity, for us to grow in these infused virtues. And although Aquinas insists that even the growth and the increase of the infused virtues is God's work and not ours, he also acknowledges that we can dispose ourselves to receive an increase, and we can merit growth in these virtues by practicing them to the extent that we are able. It's precisely with respect to learning about the right use of these gifts that imitation of the saints becomes important. We can see how they use these virtues that God endowed them with, and we can learn to use the virtues that God has given us in a similar way. But, and this is the last difficulty, are the saints really the right exemplars for us to imitate in order to grow in these infused virtues? When the church canonizes saints, it seeks out and scrutinizes evidence that not just that the saints exercised the infused virtues, but that they, quote, give outstanding testimony to the kingdom of heaven by the heroic practice of the virtues. That comes from the documents of the church on canonization. So while the technical criteria for what constitutes heroic virtue have developed over time, but one contemporary theologian argues that the way the church thinks about heroic virtue when it's trying to canonize the saints, quote, reflects a value given to a certain kind of spiritual achievement, attained by intrepid acts and buttressed by miracles. It customarily points to such deeds as witnessing to the point of bloody martyrdom, engaging in the white martyrdom of stringent asceticism, experiencing a radical conversion from which one does not turn back, renouncing family and worldly possessions, or pouring out lifelong dedication to the sick, the poor, and the imprisoned, end quote. In short, the saints are traditionally held to display such heroic virtue by practicing the virtues continuously rather than just sporadically, by undertaking acts of virtue that are especially demanding, and by exercising the virtues with an extraordinary degree of promptness, ease, and pleasure. One historian contends that the category of heroic virtue is intended to draw a clear distinction between, quote, the common holiness of those who have died in a state of grace and the eminent and excellent sanctity of the saints. The saints, all of us. While the holiness of the saints may not be qualitatively different from that of the ordinary person who has grace and the infused virtues, there does exist a very likely substantial gap between us ordinary Christians and the saints with respect to the intensity of the virtues and the actions that they give rise to. Recent work in psychology suggests that moral exemplars are most effective at inspiring others to strive toward moral growth when the people who witness an exemplar's excellence in action perceive the exemplar to be relevant to them and to present an ideal that's attainable. Right? So the psychological literature on imitation is like, if you want somebody to be an exemplar who's able to captivate and attract and inspire people, the people who see the exemplar need to see the exemplar as somehow relevant to me and presenting a model that I could realistically attain. Now, the saints might prove to be especially relatable on account of their cultural and historical context, occupations and interests, state of life. Think about all of the ways that the church, right, has patron saints of different groups, different causes, different professions, and so on. The attainability part seems a little more difficult. To an ordinary person, exhibiting the degree of charity that characterized St. Damien of Molokai's work with the lepers, or the intensity and courage that animated St. Edith Stein to endure martyrdom, might seem quite remote, not just because of contextual differences in their lives, but perhaps more significantly, because we recognize very keenly the way that our moral capacities fall quite short of theirs. I think one key to overcoming this obstacle to the attainability of the saints as exemplars concerns the way that we present the saints. Frequently, Christian preaching about the saints focuses in on just sort of discrete episodes of the saint's most heroic virtue. Saint Maximilian Kolbe, taking another man's place in the starvation bunker, or Saint Francis, right, and his radical embrace of Lady Poverty. These are the things that preaching about the saints tends to focus on. These little episodes depict the saints as the pinnacle of what human beings, healed and elevated by grace, can achieve. They present them as what we might call goal exemplars, whose acts of heroic virtue display the perfection of the human person. Recognizing the saints as goal exemplars is important because those who exemplify the peak of human moral achievement alert us to possibilities of moral excellence that we might not otherwise have thought were possible. But to state a point that's obvious but often overlooked, the saints are not born with the ability to exercise heroic virtue. They, like every other human being, have undergone a process of moral development in which the virtues have been cultivated or infused, developed, and practiced. And the narratives, the stories of moral development, right, about the saints offer a crucial perspective on their exemplarity, portraying them not just as goal exemplars, but also growth exemplars, who illustrate for us an admirable pattern of growth and progress in the moral life. Looking to the saints as growth exemplars by attending to their progress in virtue also avoids one of the central dangers that accompanies our efforts to imitate, right, the saints, people whose capacities and excellence lies far beyond our grasp at the moment. Namely, that the context in which we learn to be virtuous is very different than the way a person who's already virtuous acts. The moral novice, the person who wants to grow in virtue, might have to struggle mightily in order to resist temptation or to root out things that are contrary to virtue. But the saint, if we consider her only at the peak of her moral excellence, provides no model for engaging in these processes of growth. Right? If we look at the saints just, right, in this one snapshot of them at the height of their achievement, they don't have to resist temptation. How are they going? Right? How is that example going to help me, who has to struggle, who has to sort of fight all of these impulses to be stingy or to be envious or to be angry? The saint, right, if we just look at them from the perspective of a snapshot of them at their peak, it's not very helpful to us. Regarding the saints not only as goal exemplars, but also growth exemplars, though, helps to mitigate this problem. Right? By the same token, it also helps to alleviate any problems about their relevance, since the saints' stories of moral growth are as diverse as their displays of virtue. Some saints advance steadily on the path of virtue from the beginning of their life to the end, while others went under gradual or even radical conversions from a sinful way of life to a life of heroic virtue. The sheer multitude of stories of saintly moral progress increases the odds that we can find a saint with whose journey we can identify. Consequently, the saints can be proposed as models for imitation in a way that realistically acknowledges the capacities of the moral novice, but also establishes a trajectory, right, to aspire toward moral excellence. Last section. At this point, we've considered some ways that the saints pose unique challenges in comparison to other kinds of moral exemplars. But I'd also propose that there are a few ways, two ways in particular, that the saints possess an advantage over other kinds of exemplars. And this advantage derives specifically from the theological dimension of their role. First, the saints display a mode of self-transcendence that other moral exemplars lack. The heroic deeds of moral exemplars are often thought to testify to the human capacity for ethical excellence, or perhaps to manifest what one philosopher calls transpersonal moral ideals. I have no idea what that means. The exemplarity of the saints, on the other hand, possesses what Rusty Reno calls a heroism of transparency. I like this phrase. The saints don't claim to be testaments to the power of the human spirit, but rather to the power of Christ who lives in them. To be sure, the moral excellence of the saints is readily perceptible if we have the eyes to see. But the goal of the saints' moral excellence is not merely that they should be seen and recognized, but also, perhaps more importantly, that they should be seen through. The radiance of the saints flows from Christ, whose inexhaustible brilliance is refracted in the splendid diversity of their lives. In this sense, the saints are a paradox. They are simultaneously original and derivative. The Jesuit theologian Karl Rahner rightly states that the saints, quote, are the initiators and the creative models of holiness, which happen to be right for their particular age, end quote. But the saints' originality doesn't derive from their own efforts to be trailblazers, but rather from their desire to be faithful imitators of Christ in the unique and unrepeatable circumstances of their own time and place. A recent theologian recognizes this paradox when he proposes that, quote, the lives of the saints describe not only patterns and ways of life, but also an end in God that cannot be accounted for by a single or even several individual lives. There's no typical saint. There's only Christ, end quote. To imitate the saints properly, then, is indirectly, yet consciously, to imitate Christ in his saints. The self-transcendent exemplarity of the saints, their ability to be transparent, to be seen through, reminds us that the goal of the Christian life is not just to be virtuous, but that the goal of Christian life is to be virtuous for the sake of being beholders of God in heaven. The glimpse of beatifying communion that the saints give us leads to the second advantage of their way of being exemplars, namely that the saints are accessible to us in the way that other moral exemplars are not. I mentioned at the beginning that the most fruitful relationship of imitative learning is one in which you actually know, either directly or indirectly, the person that you're imitating. Well, by virtue of the communion of saints, the Second Vatican Council affirms, quote, the union of us wayfarers with our brothers and sisters who sleep in the peace of Christ is in no way interrupted, but on the contrary, this union is reinforced. The saints are exemplars who, while they might be distant from us in time and space, are nevertheless intimately present to us by the bond of charity. This spiritual proximity between us and the saints allows us to view the saints as more than distant historical models of virtue to be imitated as sort of abstract, impersonal ideals. Instead, it makes possible a form of imitation that's grounded in loving relationship, in contact and real encounter with the saints. We can actually know the saints and not just know about them. I'm not here suggesting that the communion of saints makes it possible for us to receive spiritualized advice column by praying to the saints. But the tradition of praying to the saints, of developing a kind of friendship and companionship with the saints, does make it possible for us to know the saints rather than merely to know about them. While careful discernment is crucial when we do this, the communion of saints enables us to view the saints not just as distant models, but as true companions. To conclude, the saints are indeed moral exemplars for us, but the nature of their excellence is of a kind not so easily captured by the standard philosophical categories. The saints are not just moral heroes who happen to have an eccentric religious sensibility. Rather, the saints are, as Vatican II puts it, men and women who have been more perfectly transformed into the image of Christ, and whose exercise of the infused virtues gives us a sign of God's kingdom. Imitating the saints, therefore, is unlike imitating other kinds of moral exemplars. It cannot be, as one philosopher describes it, trying to copy for ourselves the saints' virtuous actions, at least not right away. Instead, it begins with imitating their moral growth, which is to say, with our imitating the ways that the saints responded to, cooperated with, and disposed themselves to the transformative work of God's grace. Such imitation involves our action, of course, but it's a unique kind of moral striving. Imitating the saints involves learning how to cultivate the luminous transparency that the saints possess, so that we are free not to achieve heroic virtue, but rather, as the ancient Greek theologian St. Gregory of Nyssa put it, to catch the halo.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.